half hour, because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of discussion of this paper. The next thing is at 5, what's at 5:15?
Dinner,
that's what I thought. Okay, so we might be slightly toward the back of the line for dinner. With regard to the last discussion about professors in class, I know from as a fact, in one case the person told me himself, in the other case there's newspaper accounts of this, that two of the leading historians of evolutionary biology, of modern biology, would tell students in their classes that they had to choose between believing in religion or God even, and believing in science. One of them was the late Will Provine at Cornell, who was famous for that. The person who told me himself is Garland Allen, who is a professor at Washington University, although I think he's either about to retire or has just retired. But they are two very distinguished people in my field, and this is what they said in their classes.
Well, so, I can add to the Provine story.
How's that? Yeah.
Will always took a survey at the beginning of his course, asking how many people believed in evolutionary biology, and at the end of his course. And the results were that more people did not believe in evolutionary biology.
My former colleague on ASA Council, President Walter Bradley, will introduce himself more fully if he wants.
The only thing that stands between dinner and you is me. I'm very mindful of that, and so I'll try to talk very fast and yet try to cover the subject in a way that I hope you'll find interesting. This was a topic that I didn't really know that much about until about 4 years ago. We actually had a plenary speaker when we had the ASA meeting at Baylor University where I was teaching, who talked on this topic, but I was so busy putting out fires because it was on my campus, I didn't even get to hear his presentation, and I didn't go back and follow up. So only 3 or 4 years ago, a friend of mine wrote a book that became quite popular. It sold 500,000 copies in the first 2 or 3 months. It's called Imagine Heaven. John Burke wrote it. He asked me, I was going to his church, would I be willing to review the book, not as a Christian, but as a scientist, and give my opinion on whether I thought that the claims that the book made were scientifically supportable. And so I started reading that without knowing very much about the topic at all. And I was quite amazed to find there was a lot of really, really interesting empirical data that I thought spoke to this question. I'd seen a couple of movies, but what do you do with one data point or two, right? It's not very persuasive. But when you see the amount of data that's out there, and I think the quality of it, then I think it really gives a good reason to think more carefully about this whole topic. So let me begin with a series of questions. If you were to die tonight, would you cease to exist? And if not, where would you be or how would you be? Would you no longer have a consciousness?
Just you know.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Okay, let me start over. If you were to die tonight, would you cease to exist? Would you no longer have a conscience? What did Billy Graham say just before he died this past spring? He said, people are going to say Billy Graham died, but don't believe it. I'm going to be more alive than I've ever been. I thought that was a great comment. Mm-hmm. And then Barbara Bush picked up on that. She's also a Christian. In fact, she and Billy Graham were friends. And right before she died, she said, people are going to say in the newspaper and everything that Barbara Bush died. Don't believe it. I'll be more alive than I've ever been. The question is there empirical evidence that can give us a compelling answer to this critical question, and data that would allow us to make that kind of a bold claim that these two people made? Let's begin with what the Bible has to say about heaven. I think I'd always thought of heaven as primarily in terms of what happens at the end of history when Christ comes again and he's going to fashion a new heaven, a new earth, and people are going to get their new resurrection bodies. That's what I thought of when I thought of heaven. But if I die tonight, that's not what's going to happen to me. That's what would happen to me in the future. Randy Alcorn, in his book, Heaven, which I think is probably the best comprehensive book ever written on the topic, makes the distinction, which I find very helpful. He said, let's call that eternal heaven. That's where we're going to be for forever at the end of history when Christ comes again. But he said, we should also recognize that we're going to be someplace between now and then. So let's call that intermediate heaven. It's the place people's souls live from the time of their physical death until the end of human history when Christ returns, if they're believers in Christ. Now, a few verses. We don't have a lot of time. Paul in Philippians 1 basically makes the comment is he's longing to go to be with Christ, but he's also realizing he has unfinished work. And he says what? To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. Okay? I think you'll see as we look at this topic today, that really is what's being demonstrated in a profound way. On the cross, when the thief asked if Jesus would forgive his sins, what did he say? This day you shall be with me in paradise. It was not the body. Neither of them were going to be there with the body that was dying, but they were going to be there with their spirit body, if I can call it that. I'm not sure what the right term is because I haven't seen a term for it. But there was something about them that was going to live on after their physical body died, and it was that, whatever it is, whatever you want to call it, that was going to be together in paradise. In 2 Corinthians 12, verses 1 through 6, a passage I always found very enigmatic, Paul talks about having this amazing experience in which he did what? He went to seventh heaven, and he experienced things which were too amazing to describe because he saw things that he'd never seen before, for which there wasn't a lexicon of terms. How do you describe something to people who've never seen it when there aren't any words to describe it because it's nothing you've ever seen in our physical reality? Now, when I began to study this stuff on near-death experiences, it dawned on me that's probably what Paul was having. Because when you hear the accounts that I'm going to be sharing with you this evening, at least a few examples, they all sound like Paul's experience. They all come back saying, wow, I went to a place that's so amazing and so different. I don't even know how to tell you about it. Because it's so absolutely different than what we have here. Now, when might have this have happened? Well, Paul had several opportunities to die and be resuscitated. His preaching was not always well received. And in this particular example in Acts 14, he was drug out of the city, he was stoned, and he was left for dying to die because of his preaching. Now, if you read Vaughn, he goes on back into the city, and I'm thinking, this guy's really, really tough. He's stoned to death, and I don't mean with her marijuana or whatever. He was stoned in the classical sense, not in the modern sense. But I think that's probably when this happened, and I really believe that I can't prove it, but the implications are this would at least make sense. In Mark, Matthew, and Luke, we see the talk of the transfiguration experience. And who shows up at that? Two people just kind of pop onto the scene. But they're not really like they climbed up the mountain with the rest of the three disciples and Jesus. Who was it? Moses and Elijah. And then after they were there for a time, what happened? They just disappeared. Now, people have these kinds of experiences when they have these near-death out-of-body experiences of thinking about being someplace and then just being there. Wouldn't that be nice if you live in a lot of cities like Austin? I'd like to just think of downtown and then just be there instead of driving for an hour and a half in difficult traffic. Okay, three key questions I want to try to address in the brief time that we have. Do human beings have a body and a distinct spirit or soul, okay, or do they just have a body? Will I still be conscious immediately after the death of my body? If not, what will I be? Okay? How will I be? Third question, what is intermediate heaven like? Now, the Bible gives a lot of details about eternal heaven, but it doesn't have that many details to share about what's going to happen between now and then. So we can learn, though, about some of this from the experiences that people have been having. What is intermediate heaven like, and how could we possibly find out? Great question. There's two kinds of data when people have a near-death, out-of-body experience. Now, let me make a distinction here. Not everybody that has a near-death experience has an out-of-body experience. What do I mean by near-death experience? Clinically dead in the sense that no heartbeat and no brainwave. Now, you can be clinically dead without being permanently dead, because what happens is you have this temporary time when you don't have brainwaves, you don't have your heartbeat. But if you're resuscitated sufficiently quickly, then in fact you come back to life, okay? But it's during that interval when people have no brainwave, no heartbeat, that we're talking about as a near-death experience that sometimes, but not always, is accompanied by out-of-body experiences. Heartbeat monitoring, brainwave, and again, what's interesting for some patients, not everybody, some people, after they have this kind of an experience, you ask them questions after they're brought back to consciousness and ask them, did anything unusual happen to you while you were going through this near-death experience? And for some people, maybe most people, they don't have anything to report. But for some people, they come back with remarkable stories. Now, question is, why should we believe these stories? They could be what? Fantasizing, that could be some sort of hallucinating, it could be all kinds of things, maybe. Although connecting that to having no heartbeat and no brainwave is not itself obvious. But I think what's really interesting is that these people say, while I was clinically dead, I had this out-of-body experience, and I was hovering over the operating room, and I can tell you all the things that went on in the operating room, or in the emergency room, I should say, with remarkable detail. And the doctors will say, well, give us some examples. Well, Dr. So-and-so was using really bad language. Okay? Other Dr. So-and-so is not wearing his scuffs like he should have been. And they can tell you all kinds of details of what they were doing, in a sense, scientifically, in their practice of medicine. But they can tell you all kinds of other quirky things that there's no way you would know had you not been conscious during that time when you were clinically dead. Now, there's a lot of data, and I'm going to share with you a few examples shortly, but there's a second kind of data that's not as empirical, but is much more interesting. I consider when people can tell you everything that goes on in the operating room in minute detail, things you couldn't possibly know, they're clinically dead. In some cases, they have their ears plugged and they have their eyes covered with some sort of a cover, which not only makes them dead, it means they're totally getting no external stimuli, period. I mean, it's not even possible whether they were dead or not. When you can have people like that tell you everything that goes on in the operating room, that's a pretty empirical observation for me. And there are not just a few examples of this. There are 3,500 carefully documented examples. But the part that I think is even more interesting, but not necessarily as empirical, these people, not always, but often, say, while I was clinically dead and while I was having this out-of-body experience, I went through this tunnel, or I went along this path, and I went to a place that was beautiful beyond belief, and I saw things that were just amazing that I could not imagine, and I actually had the opportunity to engage Jesus along the way. But guess who else I met there? I met my grandparents, people that I've known who've already died, friends maybe who'd already died and gone on to heaven. And they never, ever report meeting people who are alive on earth. Now, I think that's an important point, because if this is subconscious bubbling up and doing hallucinations or some kind of thing like that, then you would expect it not to be quite that divided. Only dead people do people meet on their near-death out-of-body experiences when they go to what I'm going to call... What did we call it? Not permanent heaven, but intermediate heaven, okay? But it gives a preview of what might come. The other thing that happens on these is that these people almost always have a review of their life that flashes by in what may seem like I'm getting my whole life in detail, and yet it takes only a very short amount of time. People sometimes say that when they jump off bridges or stuff and say, my whole life flashed between the time I jumped and the time I hit the water. And but in this case, the focus is on what was the significance of my life. The good things that I did often were much more important than I realized. I did something that didn't maybe seem that big. It affected some people who really at a critical point in their life, it went helped them to go on and do the same, and they saw this ripple effect that was absolutely mind-boggling. And almost all of these people say that. And then the bad things that we did. I was mean to somebody when I was a teenager, and that really, my meanness to them caused them to have a lot of inferiority problems, and so they grew up to be a very dysfunctional person, and then they had dysfunctional children who had more dysfunctional children. And what these reviews help people to see is there's a lot more to our lives than we imagine, and that the impact of what we're doing is far greater than we can imagine. And it makes the people who come back from having had these are absolutely changed, almost all of them. And their lives are so different because they see things that we don't see in our normal experience. Well, let me give you some interesting examples. Mary O'Neill, director of spinal surgery at University of Southern California Medical School, also loves to kayak with her husband. They go to Chile. She's written two books that I would highly recommend. They're kayaking in Chile. She goes over waterfalls not too deep, but her boat goes under 15 feet, gets stuck on rocks. She can't get her release to work, and she's underwater for 25 minutes, maybe 30. Obviously, she dies during that time, okay? it took them 20 minutes just to finally reach her where her kayak was, and then some more time to get her out. But after almost 30 minutes of being underwater and then being dragged up to land, she was resuscitated. But she tells amazing stories of her experience, going to intermediate heaven, meeting a lot of her old friends and relatives who had died before her and are already there. She meets Jesus. She has an amazing conversation with him. He tells her some things she doesn't want to hear, like her son's going to die in an accident, and she doesn't want to believe this whole experience is true. When she gets home, she tries to figure out how this could have been anything but what it was, because she didn't want to believe the part that had to do with her son getting killed. Within a couple of years after that, he did actually get killed, and he got killed in a motorcycle accident, I think. But her experience was really, really profound, because she could analyze everything as a doctor, very experienced. Here's an interesting one, a lady named Vicky. She was blind from birth. She was 22 years old. She's riding in a taxi cab. They have a terrible accident, and she gets rushed to the hospital because she's critically injured. On the operating table or in the emergency room, she dies. Now, first thing she knows is she's up on the ceiling floating around, and she sees these doctors and nurses frantically working on some young girl who's 22 years old. She does not realize it's herself because she's blind. She doesn't know what she looks like, and she doesn't have any idea who this is. But as she's watching all this scurrying on and so forth, she notices that there's an orchid ring on the finger of one of the girl that's clinically dead, and it begins to dawn her. Also, she has real long hair, and she figures out, that's me. I've never seen me before. In her spirit body, she could see, even though in her physical body, she could not. I thought that was really, really interesting. There's a lot more fun details to these, and I'm going to make some resources available at the end. You can read about some of these people. There's a migrant worker named Maria. She has some sort of an accident. I don't remember the details, but she is rushed to the emergency room, and there they go through all kinds of quick gyrations. Well, then I'm going to have to go much faster. Okay. We will skip some of these individual examples. They're all very interesting. Let me mention just one that's fun. The man who had a massive heart attack at the bottom. He actually had clinical death. He had dentures. Because of his dying with his dentures in his mouth, he was kind of choking on them as they're trying to resuscitate him. So they pull out the dentures and they stick it in a little cart and three drawers down. And they finally get him resuscitated, but he's in a coma. And he stays in a coma for 7 more days. And when he wakes up, his first question is, where are my dentures? Nobody has any idea where his dentures are. And then he says, I know where they are. They're in the, so he describes the card. He says it's in the third drawer down. Now, mind you, they put him in there. He was deader than a doornail while all this is going on, but he wasn't, right? He had this near-death out-of-body experience. And sure enough, they went and looked very skeptically, and there were the dentures. Well, there's lots and lots of stories like this, but I'm going to have to go much faster. Okay, what kind of documentation is available? Well, there's lots of books. There's a database that has 3,500. There's a central place where people send these kinds of carefully documented stories. And by carefully documented, I mean they interview the person who has the near-death experience, and they cross-check that with what the doctors and nurses who were involved in that can confirm. 3,500 of these. Interesting, these people come from many races, many cultures, many religious backgrounds or non-religious backgrounds. They range in age from 4 to 80 years old. And yet there is a huge consistency in what these people experience. You would think if this was something that was just bubbling up from your subconscious, for example, that it would be very influenced by all of what's in your subconscious. And if you have people who have come from very different backgrounds where their subconscious information stored is so different, then they would have very, very different stories to tell, and they simply do not. Okay, let's keep moving ahead. There are examples in the mainstream media. Atlantic Magazine, for example, ran a feature story in April of 2015. I don't know how many pages it was in the magazine, but when I downloaded it, it was like 17 pages. It was very long, very thorough. The lady who wrote it was very fair. She talked about what are the arguments for this being real and what were the arguments against it as this being some kind of a hallucination or whatever that was simply allowing these people to tell these stories, but it wasn't real. The New York Times ran an interesting story on a new vision for dreams of the dying. This is not about near-death experiences where people come back. It's what people experience when they have this oftentimes encounter shortly before they died. People used to poopy-do that, and I probably was one of them, but in fact they have documented, these are not near-death experiences where people come back, they're experiences people have as they're in the process of dying, and it's often visitation by relatives who've died and gone on. The New York Times article said this is becoming a widely recognized phenomenon. It used to be sort of dismissed. I taught a class on this whole subject of near-death experiences to Seniors University in Georgetown, Texas, where we live. We had about 80 people in the class. There were two ladies there that worked in hospice, and they came up after class one day and said, this happens a lot more than people would think. And when you work in hospice, you're seeing, what, lots of people dying. And she said, it's not at all uncommon for people to have these kinds of experiences. National Geographic had a story that wasn't their main cover story, it was their second cover story. It was advertised on the cover. Newsweek recently had an article in which they basically said, it really seems strange, but it does appear there's enough empirical data to say that people really do have a conscious existence after their physical bodies die. And this is Newsweek magazine, so even in secular sources. Okay, there's lots of books available. Let me say which one I would highly recommend. If you want to read one book, right where I thought I am, I would highly recommend Imagine Heaven. John Burke wrote this. His background was in engineering before he became a pastor. He read the first book ever written on this topic because his father had been reading it when he died. He was an agnostic at the time, but he just wondered, he was curious about what his father was reading, and through that book and things that happened subsequently, he became a Christian. He has carefully studied 1,000 different of these carefully documented cases. He's interviewed a lot of people personally, and the book is full of great examples of what this looks like. Okay. Movies, well, you've probably seen some of these. I find the movies interesting, but I don't find them compelling because, again, it's this one data point. What do you do with it, you know? I like ones where you have 100 data points, and they all are very consistent, and they line up in some way. Okay, science technical literature. There's 600 refereed journal articles in a journal that's relatively new called the Journal of Near-Death Studies. You may say, well, these are all people who are partial, though, right? Because they're into this, they're studying it, they're believing it, and maybe they're cheating. But there are 240 refereed journal articles in PubMed. which is the sort of top end, I think, of medical journals, if I understand a lot. Some of you who are working in that field might confirm that, including, the ones that are mentioned there. There is a huge amount of carefully documented and peer-reviewed data about NDEs, mostly from medical doctors. There are two key questions raised, I think, by the NDE, OBE experiences. Can the mind, spirit, soul, consciousness exist apart from the brain? Is there conscious life after death? Materialists would obviously say this is impossible because you're just material. There isn't anything that when your physical body quits working, then you're finished. Many scientists who were previously skeptical now believe that the evidence validating near-death experiences is compelling and provide a substantial basis to support the hypothesis that the mind or the soul can exist apart from the brain. Well, maybe this is a good place to stop. I think it's a fascinating topic. And let me offer, see all the interesting stuff you're missing just to go eat? Too bad. I'm not very good at making time. I practiced this 3 times this afternoon, and I did it in the time I needed to. And I don't know what happens when I get in front of people. Either I talk too slow, or I BS too much on the side, or...
Well, if man does not live by bread alone...
Okay. Now, if you're interested in getting some more resources, I actually have a data sheet that has links to a bunch of really good videos. John Burke did a 6-part series at his church at the time that the book came out. 30 minutes of lecture and 15 minutes of interviews of all these interesting people that have had these experiences. They're really terrific. We showed this in our neighborhood. I went and invited a bunch of neighbors. We invited 12 couples, hoping 6 would come. I don't know if they were Christians or not. They were just people we knew. And all 12 couples came. And we said, come for the first week, and if you like it, you can come for 5 more weeks. They all came. And then before we got to the end of that, we had people calling us we didn't even know, say, I'm a friend of so-and-so that's coming to this thing you're doing. If you do it again, could you invite me? And we had it done 3 more times, all with people we didn't even know who were calling us because they were hearing about it secondhand. Now, I live in a retirement community, so I always tell people, this is a topic that's very relevant. So this is really the sweet spot for the people that we know there. But I think it's a terrific way of thinking about these things. I think we're out of time. I don't know if we can have a Q&A or not. And let me add, after the 2 or 3, the people who are hungry can leave, and I'm happy to stay around.
Whether they were believers or not believers, for example, Stephen Dawkins had the same out-of-body experience as someone.
On the PowerPoint, which I'll send you. Now, I put my email address up because I didn't want you to write yours down because I can never separate the zeros from the O's and the L's from the 1's. And so if you'll send me that, I'll send you the whole PowerPoint. But the answer to that is, people's near-death experiences sometimes take them to a hellish experience, okay? And one of the examples in John Burke's series that he does is a professor from University of Kentucky who was an atheist. He won some major sculpturing awards. He was in the art. He was an art guy. And he spent 15 years trying to persuade his students to be an atheist. And then he had this near-death experience when they were taking a bunch of kids on a art tour in France. And it literally scared the hell out of him, okay? And he not only came back and became a Christian, he became a pastor. He's written 3 books and so forth. But if you look at the statistics, and I think this is important, there are at least 27% of the people that have these near-death experiences that have a hellish bad experience. But that number is obviously underreported. Because some people don't want to come back and say, I just had a near-death experience and went to hell. Well, that doesn't sound very good. But I think it's also interesting that there are some people where while they're having this near-death experience, they're being resuscitated, they're dying, and when they come back, at least momentarily, they're saying, help me, they're coming after me. You know, obviously they're having a bad experience meeting the devil, not meeting Jesus. But at the end of that, when they are finally resuscitated and brought back to life, the doctor said, did anything happen to you while you were going through this? No, I don't remember anything. Why? Because I think when you have really terribly traumatic experiences, and we know this from other sources, they will often be suppressed in your subconscious just as a way of coping. And so I think sometimes they're not reported because people are embarrassed. Sometimes they're not reported because, frankly, they're not remembered in their conscious. Yeah.
I think we'll just take one more walk. Just one more.
Explanation out of how an out-of-body person can see something?
Yeah. Well, they see all kinds of stuff.
How can they see it?
Well, I think that they have a whole different kind of a physical existence, okay? There's thousands of people that have had this experience, and they're in the operating room, they see everything that goes on. I have no idea of how they do that. You're right. It's not the way we do it. They don't have little lenses and optic nerves and all that. But somehow they have the capacity to do things that we do and things that we can't do, like fly, but it's on a totally different basis. Doesn't that sound cool? Yeah, I can hardly wait. Okay. For those of you that want to stick around, I'll be happy to answer your questions.